Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here again. And yeah, it's kind of like an annual pilgrimage, I think, at some point. I think this may be the third visit. I'm not sure. Anyways, it is a joy to be back here. And a place which resonates with the aims and purposes of my own spiritual search and awakening. And so when I come here, I always feel like I am speaking to the converted. And the people who already share a very similar vision of life and of spiritual awakening. Tonight's theme is obviously a very topical one, and one that connects with the high holy days of Christian calendar. And I want to begin on a humorous note before we dive into this subject matter. This is a story of a very famous teacher whose name was Mullah Nasruddin. And Mullah Nasruddin's stories and anecdotes have traveled from Turkey, where he was originally born, all across the world. And you'll find many Nasruddin tales circulating even in Christian manuals, Jewish manuals for enlightenment, and so on and so forth, which speaks to, of course, the universality of the mystical journey, that it is one for all and all for one. So this story gives us a little insight into the nature of tonight's talk. So anyways, he was a married man, and his wife was having, was about to give birth. And in those days, they didn't have hospitals. You didn't get to rush off to a hospital. Everything was a home birth. And they had a midwife in there, and he was sitting in the waiting room awaiting the baby with a midwife in the other room. So time passes, hour or two pass, and he, of course, is getting more and more anxious and more expecting. And so finally the midwife comes out and with a big smile on her face and with a baby boy in her hands, and he says, "Congratulations, Mullah." Mullah means teacher, one who is a teacher. He says, "Congratulations, you have a baby boy." And he says, "Fantastic, fantastic." He's jumping up and down and, of course, very, very excited. But she takes the baby back and puts the baby in a crib and goes back into the room. And another 15 or 20 minutes pass by, and the midwife comes out again, and this time is carrying a baby girl and says, "Congratulations again, Mullah, you have a baby girl." And so this is also quite amazing. He wasn't expecting, and in those days they didn't have, you know, ultrasound. So they didn't know how many were coming. So he's very, very excited and wishing upon his lucky stars how blessed he is. And of course, baby goes back with the midwife into the room, and another 20 minutes, a half an hour pass. And finally, the midwife comes out again. And this time brings out another baby girl. And Mullah looks around, doesn't say anything, runs into the room where his wife is giving birth. And in those days, of course, there were no lights, right? There were just candlelight. And he blows out all the candlelight. And the midwife is shocked and saying, "What are you doing?" He said, "We need that for the delivery." He says, "Whoever is seeing the light, they want to come out." So, reminds me of our predicament as human beings. So, I thought that a way to understand this very simple tale, I mean, it obviously has its own humorous underpinnings on many levels, but, you know, as a beginning point to interpret it, the irony is that we all are coming into the light, and we have actually come from the light, and we will return to the light. But in this sojourn here, while we are in this world, many of us are not in the light. We're in the darkness because we have not awakened to that divine light that is within us. And the humor is that if we do see that light, we will desire to come out of this, as many mystics have said, this prison house of the body that we have been locked into, so to speak, since the moment we were born. So it's an indication that we are on a spiritual journey, a journey of awakening that only gradually actually begins to dawn on us. Certainly it is a rare soul who understands this journey in the early part of their life, but many great souls, even in their 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 years old, have awakened to this truth. Most of us tend to awaken to it later in life when we begin to realize that nothing here seems to quite make sense, and that real meaning and real truths are not really available in the normal way of our living. So the resurrection, what is the resurrection? Rumi, one of my favorite mystical poets, who I am constantly reading and rereading, and encourage all of you to, if you haven't bought the Masnavi of Rumi, you should go back and read it. One of the great spiritual classics of all times, of all religions, and of, I would say, one of the greatest spiritual classics written by any human being, period. And irony, of course, is that he didn't write it, he dictated it. Dictated it in complete flowing verse. And that was just a small portion of his tremendous outpouring. But Rumi gives us, and I want to read to you a poem that talks to you about the meaning of the resurrection. And I want to build from there and then take us on a little journey in this experience of light. So this is in the Masnavi. For those of you who are want to go back, I'll give you the exact quote. He says, "On resurrection day, God will ask during the reprieve I gave you, what have you produced for me? Through what work have you reached your life's end? For what end have your food and your strength been spent? Where have you dimmed the luster of your eye? Where have you been dissipated your 5 senses? You have spent yearning, seeing, hearing, and your intelligence. And where have you spent this pure celestial substance? What have you purchased from this earth? I gave you hands and feet as spade and mattock for tilling the soil of good works. When did they by themselves become existent?" When did they by themselves become existent? So he is giving us a very, very rich and poignant view of our journey, our spiritual evolution. What are we really supposed to be doing here? And the last line, of course, is very telling. He said that we have given you this celestial substance. What is this celestial substance? It is light. It is consciousness. That is who we are. How have we spent our time in this world? What works have we done? How have we spent our hearing, our seeing, and our working? If it has not been for good works, then we have spent it in vain. And good works here is the broader, more general meaning of our spiritual perfection. So the Quran, and indeed all scriptures, whether of the East or of the West, Abrahamic traditions or Vedic traditions, talk about the single most important task that we have all come here to do. And that task is to recognize and realize our Creator, to connect with that Creator. So this is the fundamental basic journey that we are here. We have not been created simply for the purpose of survival. And yet, when we look at our lives, most of our time, sadly, is spent at the survival level, which is what? Earning enough money to pay the bank mortgage, to pay the telephone, to pay the cell phone, to pay the heating, to pay the lighting, to pay all of the necessities of life. And what have we bought at the end of all that? Rumi is saying, all of that is for naught if we have not progressed spiritually. So he gives, there's another poem where he articulates even more deeply this spiritual journey. And I'll try to do this one by memory. I often memorized it. He said, I died as a mineral and became a plant. I died as a plant, became an animal. I died as an animal and became man. When was I ever less by dying? And I will one day lose this angel, this man-like nature to inherit my angelic self. In organ tones, the self proclaims, to him we shall return. And so it is a journey of evolution that he's talking about, that we have made this incredible evolutionary journey, literally starting as minerals and rocks and moving through the vegetable kingdom and animal kingdom, and here now as human beings, it is not the end of our journey, that there is yet greater and greater life beyond this, more rich and more profound. But the graduation requirements are that we become ambassadors of the light, that we align ourselves with the light, and that we live in communion with that and light, and as true emissaries of the light that is within us, which is God's light. So I kind of divided this talk into several kind of segments on this theme of light. And I wanted to first go back and talk about our heritage as beings of light, and then kind of build from there. Almost all spiritual scriptures refer to that power we call God as light, or the primal expression of that power as light and sound, ringing radiance. It's often been called the music of the spheres. It's also been called the word in Christian tradition. It's been called Nur Allah in the Islamic tradition, literally Nur meaning God, Allah, Nur meaning light, Allah being God. It's been called Jyoti and Shruti, which literally, or Nad or Rutkit in the Hindu tradition, Nad being sound, Shruti, and Jyoti being light, Shruti being the word. So when we look and we study carefully, we see that this primal power is actually the very means by which creation has been created. So if God is an ocean of all consciousness, that first vibration of that primal power was light. And it is that light which we call the word in Christian tradition, and it is that light that has formed every plane of creation and is actually supporting us here in this physical body. So that light is within us in the form of consciousness. And so that power we call God is actually sustaining us moment to moment. And when that light leaves, they say we're dead. They say we've passed on. So the journey then is to first to understand that we are, that God is an ocean of all light, and therefore, and we being the essence of that same power of God are also light. And therefore the way back to God is to connect with that current which manifests as light and sound, because that is the current that brought us here. And that is the current, the same current that will take us back. So if you look at all of the traditions and the great mystical teachers and masters, and I'll just mention a few here, they all talk about connecting to that light. It is already within us, but we need to connect to it. So Jesus says, very strong, he says, whoever comes to me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. So it is that light that we are searching for. It is that light that once we connect to begins this process of transformation, right? So I call the beginning phase is really recognizing and understanding that we are light, that we are children of light. Actually, St. Paul says that we are not children of darkness, we are children of light. So when we understand that, we realize that our essential nature is and has the attributes of light, which is three things. Illumination, which is the experience of knowledge, higher knowledge, love, and life, which is unlimited. Those are the natural attributes of our own soul and of this light, which is within us. So it follows very simply that if we can connect to that light, we will experience in gradual measure this unlimited energy of the universe, which is really God's energy. We will experience that unlimited insight, which is the nature of truth. And we will experience what we are all after one way or the other, and that is this experience of deeply fulfilling love. And for want of a better term, we call it unconditional love. Because it's not conditioned upon anything that happens in this world. So it's not something that happens because we're in relationship with someone. It's something we realize that is within us already, that we are that love. So this journey is really all about connecting to that. So I want to go back a bit and just take a look at this idea of resurrection. Mystically speaking, the great masters of different traditions have talked about resurrection, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about what does that really mean. So when we look at the so-called resurrection of Christ, right? Well, first of all, we have to distinguish between Christ and Jesus. There is a difference. This is something that is not often understood. Christ was the power working through Jesus, which is eternal, which never dies, which is never ending, which is the light and sound power. And you can call it the Christ power, you can call it the Guru power, you can call it the Master power, you can call it the God power. That is eternal. That is everlasting. And that is the light that we're talking about. So that is not the same thing as the physical form in which it was manifested, which was Jesus, the human being. So when Jesus rose from the dead, well, first of all, no one was there, at least no, probably no one in this room. Although you never know. Did he rise? Was it his physical body that was resurrected? Or was it his spiritual body? And when you think about it, okay, the reality is both are possible. All right? It is possible for a master, a true spiritual master, to rematerialize the atoms of this universe and manifest as a physical form. Not a big deal, actually. Not a big deal. We think it's a big deal because we don't see it every Sunday when we go to church. This experience is actually pretty normal. And we also have in the New Testament, we have these instances of miraculous, of raising the dead. Jesus rose Lazarus from the dead, right? He brought that power called the Word back into the form that was called Lazarus. And what was it that gave Lazarus life again? It was the Word. It was that divine light and sound power, which is consciousness. These great masters are the masters of that. And therefore, they can command the forces of life because they are the life principle. Okay? So then the question arises, okay, so these masters have that power. What are they really doing? Because they are one with that light, they are one with that eternal principle of life, they can give and take that life because they are now operating as if, all right, they are the conscious co-workers of the divine plan. Think about that. The conscious co-workers. They have merged their will in the will of God, and therefore whatever they do is also God's will. They are not separate from God, Jesus says. All the great teachers have said, I and my Father are one. it is a mistake to believe that only Jesus said that. That only comes from the lack of reading in sufficient number of other traditions. The more we read, the more we see that every great spiritual master said the same thing. That basically, I and my Father are one. Rumi said it. Hafiz, another great Persian mystic, said it. All right. Prophet Muhammad said it in his own way. Many Guru Nanak said it. Kabir said it. And many, many other saints, known and unknown to us, who were not the founders of religion, have said the same thing. So when we become united with that God power, Christ power, Guru power, Master power, whatever name you want to call it, then we are also in command of the forces of life. So Jesus resurrected Lazarus because there was more work for him to do in his spiritual journey. Because none of the things that these great masters do they do for our selfish benefit. They do it for the spiritual benefit of those concerned and other people as well. So if he can raise the body of Lazarus, don't you think he can raise his own body physically? But what would be the point of that? What would be the point of that, raising his physical body? Well, maybe he wants to prove to a few people that he can do it, right? But if you look at the tradition in another way, you see that what he really was doing was appearing in his astral or light body. Yes, he could appear in the physical body, but he was appearing in his light body. And that body, because the way they describe that body in the New Testament, as fragmentary as it is a body of light. It is a body shining and scintillating. And that we call the light body. Others have called it the Guru Dev, or the radiant form of the spiritual masters. So it was that body that he shone to other people, and they thought that he was somehow risen from the dead and therefore had conquered life. Look, he conquered death a long time ago. He didn't conquer it at the last moment. No. He was the master of this long before he had to leave the body. When the time of his death came, you think he didn't know that he would be put on the cross? Masters know the time of their coming and the time of their leaving, and they choose how they will go and the manner in which they will go. Years, decades. Actually, it's already determined before they come into this world. So, was he really resurrected? No, he had been resurrected. He was the living embodiment of the light his whole life. So this is to give you some deeper understanding of what this term resurrection means. He was teaching us that we need to be the resurrection. Not that he needed to do it. He did it already. He had done it many times. And he was living through his light body throughout his ministry. And probably long before that. Probably long before that. He was showing his disciples, 13 of them, right? Not great numbers during those days when you look at it, really, okay? And one we have to kind of question, right? He was showing only those who were ready to understand, the rest of humanity was not ready, that there is a spiritual transformation that we must all undergo at the time of death. This is the teaching. Where is that in the new? Where do you hear that? You will only hear that if you hang around the mystics. You will not hear that from people whose inner eye is not open, who do not have the capacity to leave the body, who do not have the capacity to resurrect every day. So here's the good news. You all have a physical body. It's a very impermanent place. Everybody gets the eviction notice one day, sometimes a lot sooner than you may have anticipated. We look around, we see our friends, all of a sudden popping off, right? Disappearing, friends, family, no guarantees, right? But the good news is that we have a spiritual body. And that spiritual body is the challenge that we have to create and inherit. That is your light body, okay? In the New Testament, St. Paul calls it the body incorruptible, all right? It's also been called the astral body or the light body, all right? In Sufism, it's called the man of light, all right? So this light body, all of you, all of us can inherit if we do the spiritual work in this lifetime. So Jesus is teaching us that the real work is here and now. It's not after you die. It's too late then. Whatever we are here, that's what we are in the beyond. All right? Whatever we are here, that's what we take with us into the beyond. So what we want to be able to do is exactly what Jesus did. Be able to leave this body and enter into our body of light and travel as he did in the inner spiritual dimensions are being through the grace and the protection and guidance of a competent spiritual master. That is what he's enjoining us to do. So it is a practical science. It's not mumbo jumbo. It is a profound, actually, the science of all sciences, the mother of all sciences. And if we learn this science, we too can resurrect daily. Daily. Even hourly. That means that we have the ability to come and go at our will and pleasure. So all of these teachings are found in the writings of the great mystics, but we don't have the correct interpretation because you can only get the correct interpretation from those who themselves are experiencing it. So a practical science means that it's like an experiment. We have to follow the rules of the experiment. And these researchers after truth, we call the great saints and the mystics, have developed this science over a millennia. Does this science belong to Hinduism? No. Does it belong to Jainism or Sikhism or Islam or any tradition? No. It is hardwired into you. It has no ism on it. Okay? In the same way that there is no Hindu light or Buddhist light or Christian light or Jewish light, there is one light and that is the light of God. That light is the light that takes you into the beyond. It is that light we have to connect to. And it is a practical science and it has very specific requirements, just like any experiment. And we have to learn those requirements in order to practice this science, and it is precise. So what you can't do is create your own experiment. It's like baking a cake. You start mixing with the ingredients, you're no longer gonna get a cake. You might get something else, but you're not gonna get a cake. So this is a practical science that is learned from those who are practical teachers, and we call those competent masters, who can give us the experiment and show us how to enter into that light, to actually align ourselves with that light, begin to shine that light, and eventually become that light. That is the journey. And it all starts with this simple process of meditation, which is aligning ourselves with this light. So I wanted to share a story with you about the misunderstanding people have, I think, or the disinformation, perhaps we could say, that is often narrated in various places. And it's a story about, and again, this is a story that appears in many different traditions, and I'm surprised often in my reading how often the same story appears with a little tweaking in another. And this is a story of Vishnu. And one day Vishnu decided to have a huge feast. Vishnu is one of the three vice regents of the absolute power in Hinduism and responsible for creation and maintenance. So he decided one day he was going to have a huge feast. And in this feast, he was going to invite not only all the gods and demigods, but he was also going to invite all the lower order of creation, all the brutes and the beasts as well. And at this feast, he had the gods and demigods on one side, and he had the brutes and the kind of lower order of creation on another side. And he prepared this huge, magnificent feast. And they both had the same feast on their table. And he told everyone, listen, I want you to eat to your heart's content. And the only stipulation is that you can't bend your elbows. You have to eat the food without bending your elbows. So there's a long table. There's people seated on either side of the table. And so the brutes and the lower order of creation were all cursing at Vishnu, saying, what kind of a joke is this? You know, you've come to humiliate us. This is such arrogance and pride on your part, tempting us. And so they were really, really upset and utterly ungrateful, obviously. And on the other side, same situation, one long table, two people on either side. Within a few minutes, they figured out how to solve this mystery. And they started feeding each other without bending their elbows. So the story is a powerful story to explain to us what is this process of resurrection. It is moving from self to selflessness. The minute you start thinking of feeding others, you're beginning the process of resurrection. The minute we are so wrapped up in our own littleness, our own separation, our own I-ness, we are far from that resurrection. So it is that shift from I-ness to thou-ness, from me-ness, right, to thou-ness, that is what this whole spiritual journey is all about. That is what the whole journey is. And it summarizes it very beautifully in this little anecdote. In another Hindu wisdom tale, they ask Vishnu a question. He says, listen, I know you're in charge of, you know, these hells and heavens and everything. He said, how do you keep track of all of these people coming from all these different cultures and religions and putting them all, how do you maintain order amongst all this tremendous job you have? And Vishnu says, I don't do anything. He said, everybody comes with their own heavens, self-made heavens and hells. I just give them a place to stay. So I am making the point that this is the resurrection. It is what we do now to transform ourselves into beings of light and love. That is the whole journey of why we are on this planet. That is the journey, all right? To make that transformation possible. So, and here, in addition to the practical science of meditation, and at the end here, we're going to sit, I'd like to sit for a few minutes of meditation, and then afterwards, we have time for a few questions. I want to share with you some highlights on what does it take to make this transformation from selfishness to selflessness, because that, in essence, is what the whole path is about. That is what the whole tradition is. As we make that transformation, we find that we no longer think of ourselves, but we begin to realize the fundamental truth that we are all one, that consciousness is one, and that your light and your light and my light and all of the little lights in all of us here are all one. That whatever I do to anyone else, I have done to myself. It not in some theoretical, poetic, metaphorical way, but in concrete, substantial karmic reaction, okay? So to resurrect, we have to realize we're all one. And the realization of our oneness is very different than the intellectual knowledge of our oneness. That's a no-brainer, all right? Anyone who's read anything at all knows that is a fundamental tenet of all traditions, right? But the realization of that in our day-to-day life only comes about when we actually connect with the light. Hence, it is a practical science. It is something we have to do every day. It is the work that actually resurrects us. Jalaluddin Rumi said very beautifully once, he said, work in the invisible world at least as long as you work in the visible. He's giving us a pretty high task. He's saying, okay, you put in 8 hours of work, all right, now go do 8 hours of meditation, all right? So we are eventually should be in that place where we never leave the light. We connect with the light, we begin to shine that light, we are transformed by the light, and we stay in that light. And when we go into meditation, we enter into our light body, which is who we really are, okay? So one of the interesting things that happens when we leave this body at the time of death is that we appear in the very likeness of the thoughts that were prevalent during our lifetime. And there are many descriptions of this in the records of all the different spiritual traditions. So what does that mean? If our prevailing thoughts were angelic and beatific and loving, we appear in an angelic light form. If our prevailing thoughts and attitudes and activities were of a demonic, were of a brutish, were of a hateful, we appear in the same form as those thoughts. Those thoughts take shape and form, and we appear as brutes, as wild beasts, as ravenous wolves. This is what we appear as. Not theoretical here, folks. Reality, okay? That is what we... So the mask of the flesh, which we wear now, is stripped away. Because every thought has a shape and a form and a smell, and we are revealed as who we really are at that moment. Nobody can hide from anybody. And exactly the nature of who we are appears either in shining brilliance or horrific darkness. So the question is, what body are we creating? It is that light body which we inherit only when we do deeds of light. So there's a very interesting story I want to share with you that for me encapsulates the life of what I call positive mysticism. Positive mysticism, we're not running away to the Himalayas. Yes, you can spend time in retreat, but it's all about living in this world. It's about manifesting your light with those you love most in the places with all those really difficult people, right? All those really challenging situations, right? That's where we are revealed to be who we are. So the story goes that there was a monastery, a Christian monastery, that had fallen on hard times. And this monastery, inhabited by 40, 50 monks, was once very prosperous, self-sufficient, and known throughout the land as a place to go for a retreat, where the brothers were serving each other very selflessly and serving others with that same love. But over a period of time, a kind of negativity crept in slowly. And over the years, it kind of grew and it reached a kind of crisis proportion. And at that point, all the brothers were distrusting each other. They were fighting with each other. They were having arguments all the time. There was backbiting. There was ingratitude. There was highly critical language of each other. And it was getting to that pitch that nobody even wanted to be in the monastery. They all were about to leave, and many had already left because this was not a spiritual environment anymore. It had become the opposite. It became infested with a lack of faith, a lack of humanity, etc. So the elders of the community recognized this tragedy and said, you know, we got to do something about this. So when you get really desperate, you know, what do? You seek help, you seek guidance. And it so happened that there was a rabbi. Okay, you know, when you get really desperate, you know, you go anywhere. They heard that there was a rabbi who was very knowledgeable, very wise, and who had helped many, many people. I like the interfaith stories. So they invited him to come and give some advice, and they told him what was happening to the community. And he said, listen, I can't really be of much help to you. You know, these guys are pretty humble too. He said, but I can give you one piece of advice, or I can give you one fact which I think will help you. And they said, well, really, what is that? He's a man of few words. He said, well, I want to tell you that unbeknownst to you, the Messiah is in your midst. The Messiah is in our midst? They wondered, did they hear him correctly? Was this really true? So the elders of the community, he's a wise man. Must be some truth there. And they said, well, who is it? I cannot tell you who it is. So what happens? The word gets out that the Messiah is somewhere in the monastery. One of the monks is actually the Messiah. One of them. And so, because nobody knew who the Messiah was, everybody started to treat everybody as if maybe he was the Messiah. They began to treat each other with love and respect, thinking maybe that's the Messiah. I don't want to be on bad terms with the Messiah. I don't want to be criticizing the Messiah. I don't want to be backbiting the Messiah. I don't want to serve the Messiah with love. I want to serve the Messiah with joy. And since nobody had any knowledge of who the real Messiah was, all of a sudden, within weeks, there was this love that was permeating everywhere. there was this respect. Everybody was serving each other with so much love and sweetness. And everybody was seeing the Messiah in everyone else and the God too in everyone else. And instantly, almost overnight, this community, the word got out that it was charged with divinity. That people were starting to come there because they realized that there was something good going on there, and said people from all over, from even hundreds of miles away, started to come to this community. And when they would come there, there was such love and amity amongst all the brothers that they left in an ecstatic state. They left hugging each other. So this is a story about this transformation process. If we could really see the God in others, if we could get beyond that judgmental mind, oh, that is the killer, folks. The judging mind. The whole game is to get out of the judging mind. To get to that place where we do not see the good or that bad, but we see the light of God in everyone. When the inner eye is open, when we are practicing meditation on a daily basis, we see God in ourselves, and we do see the Messiah in each and every one, not only in each and every one, but in all creation, in all sentient beings. And when we see that light, it's no longer the brotherhood and sisterhood of the lip service, right? Because we have that already, and it doesn't do much good. It is now the brotherhood and the sisterhood of reality. Because we see the God power working in every sentient being. And therefore, what are you going to do? What am I going to do when I see that light of God shining back at me? The light of my own creator. You're going to serve it with love and with humility. So when the whole journey comes back to connecting to that light, aligning with that light, then shining your light out to everybody, and eventually we merge into that light and become the light. And what did Jesus say? I am the light of the world. And guess what? Also is said later, little known. He said, you are also the light of the world. Does anyone know that quote? Also in the New Testament. We forget about that one. He said, I am the light, but he also said, you are also the light of the world. So we have a divine inheritance, which is absolutely amazing. But we are spiritually bankrupt because we have not found that divine inheritance. It is waiting for us. It is being held in trust for us. In the same way that a parent will hold in trust the inheritance that their child is supposed to receive when they reach the age of maturity. And what is the age of maturity spiritually? When we see the light of God in others, when we have moved from myness to thou-ness, from selfishness to selflessness. That is the journey. And when we get to that point, your divine inheritance, it's already there for us, folks. It's waiting. It's not like it has to be created. We are all spiritual millionaires. So I'd like to end with a short little story about our present state and then lead you into meditation. This is a story about a person who was in prison, and he was apparently locked up in prison because he was bankrupt, insolvent. And he had a very bad habit, which got him into a lot of problem in his normal life. And then he was very greedy and had a ravenous appetite, which he could not control. So because he couldn't pay his debts back in those days, they threw him into prison. Today we don't have those prisons, which is a good thing. But in those days, they threw him into prison. And unfortunately, his ravenous appetite and greed did not disappear. And he was eating up all the food of all of the other inmates. As soon as the food was put out, this guy could eat 30 people's meals before people even get to the table. So he's an unusual guy, no doubt. Some of these stories here are unusual. Anyways, so this was going on day after day, week after week, and the inmates started to complain. They said, listen, you know, we got to do something about this guy. He's eating up the food of 30. He said, either you expel him or get someone to get a trust fund to support his food habit. Because the prison situation is not working. And so they complained to the officials at large and they wanted to have a hearing. They explained the hearing to him and said, listen, so either he go, you have to get him out of here one way or another because it's not working. So put him, give him his own separate prison. So as the story goes, the officials in charge heard the plea and they went back to actually verify the fact that this guy was really as ravenous and greedy as they said he was. And they said, well, look, we have a plan. Here's what we're going to do. Normally, we would have kept him locked up. But what we're going to do is we're going to release him. But what we're going to do is we're going to parade him around town so that nobody gets burnt by him again because he was borrowing money and he wasn't paying back his debts. And we're going to make sure that every single person in town knows, since we're releasing him, that he is, don't lend him a penny because he's not going to pay you back and keep him away from your food. All right. So they figured this is the best solution. So they take him around towns and he agreed to it. And so they take him around town. They're beating the drum wherever they go, around every nook and corner, within every house, and they make sure that every single person in the town knows that this guy is a greedy insolvent, bankrupt. And of course, the people in the prison were very, very happy, and everything seemed to work out. So the story is really a metaphor on three levels for our spiritual condition. So in the same way, in this prison house of the world, the food of faith is scarce. The food of faith is scarce, being eaten by, ooh, being eaten by the greedy mind, all right? We have a term for it, right? This is the greedy, restless mind that is taking away, literally eating up our spiritual future. So I'm getting very practical here, okay? What are the things that keep us from that spiritual inheritance? So as a result, what happens is this greedy mind, which we all have that greedy mind that is run by desires, that is pulled by selfish interests. Remember, selfishness, greed, selfishness, they go together. They're one and the same, actually. There's no difference between the two. And it is that greedy mind, it is that greedy selfishness that eats the food of faith. And faith is the food that we need to have in abundance to travel on this journey. We need to know and believe that that spiritual inheritance is waiting for us and that it is ours, but we have to believe that it is there. And the second part of the story is even more interesting. It is a metaphor for our own spiritual bankruptcy. So what does God do in this journey? God teaches us about our spiritual bankruptcy so we come to understand where the real reality lies. You follow? So we run after everything in this world, and everything comes to naught eventually. Comes to naught, comes to nothing. All the money gets, it's gone. Everything gets taken away. It's like the man who is grasping at the bubble, and every time he grasps it, it disappears, it pops. It's like the person who is in the desert and sees the beautiful oasis, and as soon as you get close to the oasis, it disappears. And so it is with everything that is seemingly tangible and real that we go after in this world is actually intangible, not real, and a bubble, a phantom, a shadow. So God teaches us through that insolvency. He shows us that we are, and this is the hard part of the journey, he shows us how imperfect we really are in order that we will seek his perfection. And everybody gets the same curriculum. Everybody. He brings us to naught. He brings us to naught in order to see that God is all. He brings us to naught in order to see that God is all and everything, and there is nothing other than God. And this is exactly what the Sufi zikr says. La, 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 la. There is no God but God, but we have been worshiping everything but God. So God brings us through our own greedy mind to a state of spiritual bankruptcy so that we can see that there is nothing in this world that we should be looking at other than God Almighty. And that is the journey from the darkness to the light. So I'd like to share with you a meditation technique. And hopefully we can have a chance to experience a little bit of this effulgence, of this illumination, which is your birthright. So this process is very, very simple. Thank you. Just get into a position which you can sit comfortably for about 5 or 6 minutes, 7 minutes, 8 minutes. And this is doesn't matter what religion or spiritual tradition you belong to, because that light is within you, and that light is who you are. So the first step is just get into a position in which you feel comfortable. Your back should be straight but not rigid, not tilted to the right or to the left. Close your eyes very gently. And look into the screen of awareness that is lying directly in front of you. We call that which sees the darkness, the third or the single eye. It's also called the Shiva Netra, been called the tenth door, been called the eye of Shiva, it's been called many different things. This is the point at which our light connects with the greater light. So we want to look intently and minutely into the center of whatever we see in front of us, holding our gaze steadfastly penetratingly, but without clutching, without holding, and certainly without analyzing anything, okay? So if thoughts come, just let them come and go. Each thought, just let it go. Release it and let it go, and keep that gaze focused in the center of whatever you see in front of you. So again, if any thoughts come up, don't analyze, don't critique, don't judge. Just let them come and go and keep bringing the attention back to that screen of awareness. It is through that screen that gradually this inner eye begins to open. And if our gaze is penetrating and our thoughts begin to slow down, then an inner light will begin to appear. And in order to help you with this process, one way that we can help control the mind is to repeat any name of divinity or any name of God that you find comfortable or useful. And that repetition should be done very slowly at intervals, and that will help you continue to gaze so that you can develop greater and greater concentration and less thinking. And as I said, the last piece of it is, if any light appears, however small, tiny pinpricks of light or sudden flashes of light or any bursts of colors or spiritual vistas, just absorb yourself into that light. That light is who you are. Dissolve into that light just like a ray returning to the sun or a drop dissolving in the ocean. Boundaryless, open awareness, expansiveness. We are that light. So the sitting will be for about 5 or 6 minutes, and I'll bring you out with the sound of my voice. So let us begin. Please leave off. And just gradually open your eyes as the light comes on. Take a minute to acclimate yourself back to your physical senses here. And I guess this is the question portion of the program, am I right?
What religion did you grow up with?
I grew up as a Christian. My mother was a daughter of a minister, and my grandmother was actually a practicing Christian mystic, actually, my mother's side.
It's wonderful.
Hi. Just, I guess, clarification on the resurrection on a daily basis. What do you suggest? I mean, going from selfishness to selflessness, but it's like moment to moment you're talking about and how we resurrect just every minute.
Well, the basics are meditation, that we need to connect every day in meditation. Meditation is the technology of connection. So if you don't have a meditation practice, you should get one. I would say three things are essential for the journey. A competent spiritual master who can help connect you, protect you, and guide you. The importance of spiritual community, because it's in community that we learn how to support and be supported, how to give and to receive. And our spiritual practice, which is the food of the spirit, and that is every single day to try to connect with that experience of light. That light is within us. What prevents us from seeing that is the veils of mind and matter and ego. And so, but as we whittle away at that mind, matter, and ego, one day that light does dawn. And through the grace and through the guidance of a competent teacher, that process can be facilitated in a much quicker basis. But that's what we need to do on a daily basis. And a time comes, and it does not happen overnight, where as we begin to see that light, we then, even with open eyes, we see that light. And so the process of resurrection is actually really just leaving the body consciously at the time of meditation and traveling in our light body to these higher spiritual dimensions, which are our birthright. Those are the dimensions that we will go to at the time of death anyways, so if we have developed it, right? So it's a practical science. It's something, and my spiritual master used to say, an ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory. So whatever you do, put meditation number one on your list. Make that your number one commitment to yourself. And I think basically from that commitment, the other things flow pretty naturally. The light, you know, this experience of light is not far from us. It is our ego that prevents us from seeing it. It is the ego which blocks the inner vision. So as we become more and more selfless, as we truly begin to live for others and not for our own selves, right? Then that light comes automatically. God is seeking us more than we're seeking him. Him, her. Yeah.
Thank you. My question is, it's easy to see the oneness in the divine light in everyone. But it's also, there seems to be a common theme in the desire that people have.
Seems to be a what?
A commonality in the desire that everyone has. Everyone seems to desire the same things. So I see a strange parallel, whereas we all have the light, but we all have the desire. Is there any type of parallel to that, or is that something we could use to help us control the desire, turn it toward the light? I just saw that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
It's a mere reflection in a way, and I don't understand it.
Well, you're touching upon actually a very profound insight, and that is that it is this greedy mind that is directing us to the world all the time in the hopes of finding some sort of fulfillment. And unfortunately, we don't really find the fulfillment there. But all of minds are directed outward. One image that works for me is the image of wings, and that these wings that we have are wings of our spiritual aspiration. But when we indulge in a desire in the world, it's kind of like ripping the wings off one feather at a time. And so the more we direct our attention into the world in the hopes of fulfillment of some sort, it's like pulling the feathers out of our wings, the very wings that would take you heavenward. So, and everybody's mind, the interesting thing is that everybody's mind is the same. And whether, it doesn't matter what religion you belong to, it doesn't matter what race you belong to, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, the mind is the same everywhere. The mind was the same 2,000 years ago. It was the same 500 years ago or 5 days ago. It is, it's that nature of the mind itself, which is outward going. And so we have to train it to go inside. And to do that, we have to understand the ephemeral, illusory nature of the physical world, the impermanence of this physical world. And as our understanding deepens, as we begin to understand, then the attachments that we have begin to loosen slowly. And we begin to realize, that wasn't that great after all. And we begin to have that right understanding. And from that right understanding, we begin to redirect our attention inwards. But the important thing, it's a process, all right? And it's coupled with the practice, all right? So detachment, contentment, gratitude, selfless service, all of these things help us to get to that state quicker. So those are the things that, and they help us move away from what the Buddhists call the 5 unskillful actions, which are hurry and worry, agitation, restlessness, doubt, uncertainty, depression, anger, those things. So yes, absolutely, but it's a process. And we have to be able to make the commitment on a daily basis to really commit to that practice. And this is how that evolution begins.
I recently made a room in my home for meditation. And it took me a week to get all together the room, and finally when I ended the room of meditation, I was so exhausted that I haven't been meditating because I prefer to sleep before and more than anything. And it was hilarious because before I had no room where to meditate, and I was trying to meditate anywhere. Mm. Anywhere, and there was no room, and I felt so like I need a room for this. And when I made the room, I just was so tired. And I felt that also things, many ideas. But the thing is that I started 5 minutes a day. This is not long ago. I started 5 minutes, I increased it to 10, 15. And the last time I had a meditation when the room was finished, it was an hour and a half. And I didn't even notice. Mm. And my husband was wondering, and he said, "Well, what do you see in your meditations, or what do they tell you?"
What did they tell you?
Nothing. There's nothing, but something comes for sure. But I don't know. And the funny thing is that, well, I've been the last few days that I couldn't meditate, I've been a little impatient and with myself, but as a result with others too. I see that taking that time now is kind of it's vital, it's necessary. And if we don't do it, we cannot be the best to others either. And I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you. Very insightful, yeah. I think, just to build on your comment, that, you know, it does meditate. You start your practice of 5 or 10 minutes, but if you're diligent about it, and if you work on it, gradually it grows, and it becomes something that if you miss, you feel like you haven't taken a shower, you haven't eaten. And once you develop that practice, it becomes part of your routine, it becomes part of who you are, and you begin to feel. And one day, all of a sudden, you find yourself, instead of 10 minutes, you find yourself sitting for an hour and a half and coming out. And what happens is that as we root our attention inside of us, which is the only place of permanent peace, we start being less affected by all the ups and downs of life. And the reality is that all outer happiness is conditioned upon what's happening outside. But the peace and the bliss is not conditioned by anything on the outside. So when we connect with that, we're connecting to the one place that is permanent, everlasting, and secure. And you begin to experience what you did, right? We become less reactive. We're more established in who we are. We're not pulled and torn and distracted by every little thing that comes up in our lives. There's a kind of inner stability and strength that comes from that. And also with it, the experience of faith, because there's something real that you are experiencing. And that's the real faith, the faith that is unshakable. So absolutely, congratulations to you, and you will be an inspiration to many. And people are probably thinking, hey, gee, if she can do it, I can do it. Right? We can all do it. All right? I do a meditation series in our center in Long Island, and you know, it's a 6-week series, and people come in there who've never meditated before and they want to meditate, and the first every week people come back and they report that they have sat every single day. And so people looking around the room saying, oh, well, if they can do it, then I can do it. And that's the purpose of community, that we realize that, look, she's got a more challenging outer lifestyle than I do, and she finds time to do it, or he finds time to do it, and look at how it's helped him. So this is how community helps us. This is why it's so important to nourish ourselves in community and stay connected to a spiritual community, and stay connected to the people who are traveling in the same direction, because they will support you, you'll support them. We need that, all right? Very, very important. So that's just another example of that. And amazing, amazing things happen. Yeah.
When you were saying that all of our minds are the same, and the greedy mind, and we should learn to focus that inward, is that so we can become less I and more thou? And when you mentioned the different Buddhist things and depression being one of them, do you think that the different mental illnesses are spiritually based?
Well, okay, so the first question was that when you go within, do you lessen these desires, really, the greedy mind, right? And the answer is absolutely. And the reason is very similar to what her question was, that what happens is that as we begin to experience something that transcends the impermanency of the outside things, we begin to get established in what remains permanent and real. And as we begin to taste that experience, right, it begins to create a transformation in us, all right? I would say a spiritual revolution actually happens. And that revolution is a transformation of the heart from one that has been living in and of the world to the one that is just in the world but not of the world. All right, and there's a difference. So one who can make the best use of everything that God has given us but not attached to all of those things. All right. So, and that leads to states of gratitude and contentment, right? That we accept whatever we've been given, but we begin to really focus on what is lasting, what is permanent, not only for ourselves, but other people. And it gives us a deep, deep appreciation. So that mind is basically the same everywhere, right? And the second question, or as part of it, was do those mental states, will they, can they be changed or aided through meditation? Was that basically it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yes, absolutely. In fact, or are they spiritually based? Right. I would say that we are all addicts. Yeah. Addicts. Okay. There are some of us that are addicts in a real sense of the term. I won't say the real sense of the term, but addicts for drugs. There are people who are addicted to power. There are people who are addicted to sex. There are people who are addicted to alcohol. All of those are addictions. They're all forms of addictions. And those addictions produce or are produced by the desire of the soul to reach or to have completion, to experience something lasting and real. And because it's not out there in those things, right? And because the nature of the soul or consciousness is to be attached somewhere. So we either get attached to the world, which is painful, or we start learning to attach ourselves to God, which is not only painless and pain-free, but blissful. And so most of, okay, the habituated, reactive, and conditioned patterns of thinking lead to states of dis-ease of one kind or another, both physically and mentally and spiritually, all right? So the real answer, and those are all ultimately spiritual maladies due to the addictions we have. And so the way I like to put it is this: we are all drunkards. Drunk on the physical pleasures of this world's entanglements, etc. That's what we really are. And to get free of that prison, all right, we need to see where the real truth is. And we remain drunkards of one sort or another, you know, wildly going from one thing to the other, hoping that that will provide that piece of joy and happiness that ultimately will not be there. It has to go inside. So there, from our perspective, from my perspective, from our teaching's perspective, they're all spiritually based. And they can be treated